Welcome to the Gautrain Talks podcast station, the place to be for all matters related to the Gautrain and how it came to be South Africa's first ever high-speed commuter rail system. In studio today, Olaas van Sail, the former project coordinator on the Gautrain project between 2000 and 2016 and a former CEO of the BKS Group and former MD of Kotelia Projects. Olaas, welcome. Let's start with your role and your involvement in the Gautrain project. Where did it all start and how did you get involved?
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I was project coordinator on the project for 16 years, which is a long period. We were appointed in April 2000, and this was after Premier Tokyo Sekwale announced the project as part of 10 Blue IQ projects, which the province of Gauteng wanted to develop. And the engineering consultants were appointed first in April that year. And then later that year, the legal and the financial consultants were also appointed. And that consisted or made up the provincial support team, as we called it later on, PST. Of course, there were lots of other disciplines also working on the project, but they were appointed as sub-consultants of these main disciplines of consultants.
Now, you mentioned consultants. There were obviously plenty, as you mentioned, different areas and different teams. Just give us a sense of the scale. How many different consultants, ballpark figure, or different companies are involved at this sort of initial phase?
Maybe just before I come to that, just give you an idea of what we initially did. The first things we did initially was to determine what type of rail we're going to and service we're going to provide. We had to do a feasibility study. We registered as a PPP project, a public-private finance or public-private partnership project. And for that, we had to pass certain hurdles at National Treasury. The first, to submit a feasibility study. So that was the first thing we had to do.
And how long did that feasibility study take?
That took until the middle of 2001. We submitted it. And the approval of that feasibility study we got in February the next year, which was 2002, which then allowed us to do two things. The one is to start with the EIA, which was a very big exercise in itself.
Environmental impact assessment.
That's right. And then also to send out the request for pre-qualification, to select the qualified bidders, which then went through a whole bidding process after that. So that was the feasibility study. Now, of course, for that we required all sorts of disciplines. After that, we went through the procurement phase. Now, a project like this is not something; it's not the traditional type of projects where you design something, you know exactly what you're going to build, and then you develop in civil projects, also a list of quantities together with your detailed design plans. You put it out to tender and you award the tender and it gets built. Here, it's only a very preliminary design which is being done in the beginning. And so we did what I would call sort of basic planning, general planning on it. When the pre-qualified bidders were appointed, they then started with what we call preliminary design. And they based their cost estimates and their presentations and their formal proposals in the end on this. So you can imagine yourself that at that stage, a lot of work took place with the two pre-qualified bidding companies. But of course, on our side, we also had to have the different disciplines, people reacting to questions and proposals on what should be done and so on. Why I'm saying this is when the concessionaire was appointed at the end of the day and we started with construction, then we had what we call to do the monitoring on whether they in fact performed the functions according to the concession agreement, which is the Bible of the contract. And then we had a lot of people on site. Okay, with that background, at the during the construction phase or the development phase, we probably had between 200 and 250 people, engineers mostly, on site and in the in our head office. But at the other times, maybe 30, 40 people, and we drew in the expertise as we required them.
Now, when did the procurement process start properly, and what were the requirements of that process once you got going?
Well, the basic function is to develop what we call a RFP, a request for proposal. And we had, and this is one of the reasons why our procurement also took longer than expected, we did a RFP 1. The RFP 1 was just a proposal on how the RFP document should look like. Now, remember, an RFP document is a document of 1,000 pages or more, so it's a fairly thick document. And we asked the two pre-qualified bidders for their comments on this. Then we developed RFP 2. That was then the formal request for proposals, not RFP 1. RFP 1 was for comments and proposals on how the document and the project could be enhanced. RFP 2 was submitted to the pre-qualified bidders. They had 6 to 8 months, but remember at that stage they've been involved already with RFP 1.
Yes.
So they knew what was going on and they started working on it and preparing. They had 6 to 8 months to prepare their proposals. They asked for an extension and they were given an extension. The proposals came in and it was higher than the so-called affordability limit. The amount given to us by National Treasury as to which we may not exceed. And
both bids, you say?
Excuse me?
Both the bids, you say, came in higher than...
Yes, both of the bids came higher. We then had to revise the project. Fortunately, at the end, we could convince National Treasury that we could up the affordability limit slightly, but not to the levels that the bids made or the bidders made their proposals. So therefore, we also had to introduce savings. And we went through a whole process of what we call constructive engagement, because you must remember now you're working under the discipline of people tendering for a project, and it is very confidential, and you work according to certain rules and so on. What you do with the one, you must do with the other.
Yes.
And make sure that everybody is treated fairly. But we then discussed possible savings with them. They came up with savings. I can mention, for example, one was we were originally wanting to go at the Ortia Airport, the big international airport. We wanted to go in underground and have the station underground so we can extend it underneath the runway, because the future development on the airport will be between the two main runways, will be what we call the midfield terminal. That will become the big terminal at the airport.
Okay, very interesting.
And but unfortunately, we had to go up in the air into the airport, and we saved about 350 million by doing that. And we had several savings like that, which added up to quite a large amount. Also on the Dolomite areas in Centurion, the type of rolling stock that was provided, etc., etc. So then we prepared the document and we called it RFP 3, and that came in, and that then we were in the right ballpark. But then the problem was that the bidders provided us with a shopping list of possible savings, and we said to them, "Look, we can't compare shopping lists with each other. you've got to make now a final proposal. And we agreed with them, we'll sit down with each of them and tell them which of their cost-saving proposals were acceptable and which not. And then on that, on the basis of that, they must make the choice as to what is now the their final proposal with the project. And that was then a further RFP 3B. But that just took two months approximately. And then that was now 2005, beginning of 2005. And then in May, June that year, the second of July, the preferred bidder was announced by the, and it was, although there was a political committee, and I can come back to that a little bit later,
yes,
we said we wanted the whole provincial cabinet to be involved. You must realize in a project like this, the accusations or suggestions on bribery and corruption and so on, especially after the big arms deal and the suggestions around that, we had to be extremely careful.
Also, so, the scale of the project.
It was a big
project of CPEC numbers as well.
So we said, no, we wanted the whole full provincial cabinet to make the decision and to take the responsibility for it. So they did that on the 2nd of July, 2005, and then you start now you've got your RFP document now. If I can come back to that in a moment, it consists out of general issues, and the second, it's three parts, and the second part is what we call essential minimum requirements. That specifies what the project must look like. And the third part is then the proposed concession agreement. So it's a draft concession agreement. Mm. Now the bidders come and they make their proposals. And their proposals here and there deviate from this, and it enhances it further because it's more detailed. And the two of those documents then make up the final concession agreement. But the RFP has the priority above the concessionaire proposals. Because all along the project, they will come and tell you, but this is what we proposed, although that is what you wanted. And if there's an argument on that, there's a clause in the CA saying that the original essential minimum requirements and the RFP takes precedent over the proposals. So all of these things you've got to look at. Now, I can maybe just come back to something which I think is important that people must realize.
Yes.
And this is that it's a PPP project.
Yes.
Now, what is the purpose of a PPP project? And people,
public-private partnership, yeah.
Yeah. People will say, yes, but that's to get money from the private sector. But in a project like this, only 12%, 15% of the money came from the private sector.
It was a publicly funded project by and large.
Yeah. The philosophy, without going into detail, was that government would largely subsidize the construction. And the idea was eventually, and we can talk about that later, not in the beginning because there was a patronage guarantee and so on, because it was a greenfields project. Mm. In other words, a type of project that didn't exist in South Africa, and people didn't know how the public would react and the passengers and whether it would be well used.
Yes.
We had to give certain guarantees. It was international players participating in the project, but that was the fundamental approach, that eventually it should look after itself on an operational basis.
It would be sustainable.
And it looks like it is possible for that to do so in future. But now you can also go over to other projects where the private sector would fund 50%, and up to certain toll roads where they fund 100%. And they are all PPPs, public-private partnership projects.
Yes.
Now, the other major reason why you involve the private sector is for their expertise and their experience in projects like this. So you've got to see how can you get that from the private sector, because that is not always available in government. And even if government make use of consultants in the private sector, there may be advantages of also getting it from the construction, the implementation side. And and this relates to two aspects when we talk about procurement and so on. In the essential minimum requirements for the project, we visited, for example, the Stockholm Airport to City rail project, where the essential minimum requirements was a few pages. That was it. And so the question is, but how much do you have to specify in the project?
What sort of detail do you go into?
What detail do you go in? Do you say to them, look, provide a rail system between Pretoria and Johannesburg and the airport, which must be a modern system, like the most modern systems in the world? And you leave it at that, and you say, okay, you can go further and say 10 stations or whatever. But of course, we specified it more. We worked out the route because we had to have it for the EIA, for example. Mm. We knew exactly where we wanted the stations and certain things. But to give you a small little thing which we didn't do, on the ticketing machines, we just said it had to be modern, state-of-the-art ticketing machines. When they introduced them, they didn't give notes as change. And we said, but that's not modern. They said it's state of the art. And they took us to a few places where they also had ticketing machines put in recent years that provided notes as change. And at that stage, even at the airport itself, we had ticketing parking in the parking garage, ticketing machines, which provided the notes. Mm-hmm. So now can you imagine, do you say, when you say provide a modern state of the art system, do you have to specify something like this? But this is the type of decision that which you have to take when you determine your essential minimum requirements.
And what, when you're determining these essential minimum requirements, Olaust, what level of expertise did you fall back on? Because if this is a greenfield and new project to South Africa, you must have lent a lot of experience internationally to from an advisory point of view to guide the progression of this project.
Yes, the provincial support team, coming back to what were the requirements for those people to be appointed, we made sure that, first of all, they were big enough with all the in-house expertise in their particular fields, of course, and also had relationships with international companies. So, for example, the three technical companies, one of them had an association with an international company. Our financial company had a relationship with Rothschilds, for example, which is also an international financial company. On the legal field, our legal company didn't have it, but we then appointed a company in London, Masons, which had experience of rail PPP projects and getting the RFP documents and the CA developed. So, yes, but our people in South Africa, I can tell you, I was amazed in this project because we worked with international people on all fronts. And our South African consultants doesn't have to stand back for any of them.
Okay.
So yes, we had quite a lot of international expertise inside our South African companies, but we had to give the confidence. A major international company like Bombardier, who did the rolling stock, or Buick, who's one of the biggest construction companies in the world, they will not take the risk to get involved in a project in South Africa if they're not sure it is probably based and the necessary legislation, it functions properly and so on, because the size of the project, it's just too large. The financial risk is too large if it's not properly run. So that was the reason why we also made sure that we had international companies involved in our site to give the confidence to these people, don't worry, this this project is on par with anything you can get internationally. And actually, you probably heard, but in the end, we won prizes, international prizes for the project when it was compared to other projects in the world.
We are still with Olaas van Sail, former project coordinator on the Gautrain project, and we've been discussing the issue of procurement and the lessons learnt along the way. Take us back a step there and just take us through the steps from a procurement point of view.
We appointed the pre-qualified bidders. We had about 10 companies expressing an interest, but only two qualified, which is just about the minimum. I think if you look at it, theoretically, you would say, I would like to have at least three or four. But out of the 10 that made proposals, only two qualified. And you can argue that maybe our requirements were too stringent. And we had certain requirements, for example, that the same rolling stock train provider couldn't tender for more than one. And this provided a problem because there aren't all that many. The real big companies working in this field, there are only a few international. And then to set up a consortium to tender, and you can't tender with more than one if you're an expert service provider for such a project, then it starts limiting the... And that's probably the main reason. There were Japanese companies, for example, who said, but we don't provide any service ourselves. We tender for a project like this, and then we buy in all the different functionalities into the project. But they couldn't give the guarantees and the securities for the project. So we only had two. Associated with this is also then how do you work with these people? Now, what we had is what we called a bit cost compensation, which was in the end up to 200 million rands, which we provided to the pre-qualified bidders to help them in the process. We think that we subsidized about half of their total cost in the end. But this was crucial. We wouldn't have got those people to sit here for 2-3 years with big teams in South Africa, some of them international, and work on the bid process and sort of developing the process. Okay, so then we went through the bid. I've already spoken about the RFP 2 and 3 and the final RFP. What, of course, is also critical is your requirements on how do you evaluate this. Now, this is also when I spoke about bribery and corruption and those things earlier. This is where you've got to make 100% sure that there's absolutely no possibility that anything can take place. So you've got to develop an evaluation manual beforehand. You make it known, the bidders know exactly, government, the politicians, treasury, everybody knows exactly. This is the process. These are the weights. And then when you do the evaluation, you evaluate it in silos. In other words, people evaluate a portion of the proposal. They don't know what the other silos are doing. They come with the result at the top. And they submit that. And then there's only a few people who get those results in. They add it up, and they do the final evaluation. That is then presented to the, in our case, the politicians. We had a political committee. They went away for 2 weekends, and we worked with them through the whole process to make sure that they understand it, and they made the final proposal to the full cabinet. But then we also had what we call a probity auditor, which had to come in and to audit whether the whole process was done according to the manual, the weights, the procedures that were prescribed originally. So that was quite
quite a process.
Quite a process that we went through. Okay, and then as I said, the preferred bidder was appointed. We kept the other bidder also on the side to keep the preferred bidder honest, because then the negotiation follows. You then negotiate your final concession agreement.
So was that as a backup, that if you couldn't reach agreement with your preferred bidder,
we can go,
you had a second option?
We've
available.
Got a second option.
Okay.
And we thought that's going to take 4 to 6 months. It took then 15 months to do the negotiation. Now the problem was that in this whole process, although the project was not initially planned and developed for the Soccer World Cup, everybody said that'll be nice if the project can be ready for the Soccer World Cup. And then we got pressure on us to try and finish the negotiations, get the project on the go. And in fact, it was the politicians then in the end of the day, and that was actually very good, where they said to us, because as technical experts, we probably could have gone on with negotiations for another 6 months, but they said, now you've got to finish. And we finished it, and we started with construction at the end of September 2006. We had two phases. The first phase was the airport Sandton phase, and that we finished a few days before the Soccer World Cup started. And then the second phase, which was then the link up to Pretoria, and from Sandton down to Park Station, and that was supposed to finish less than a year afterwards, but it finished more than a year, nearly 2 years afterwards, because then already we started having problems with water leakage in the tunnel. And now, just to backtrack a moment, we had the PST, the Provincial Support Team. But then as part of the concession agreement, we had what we called an independent certifier. That is a further independent body that has to certify that the work has in fact been done before payment can be done.
Enormous check you against the various milestones you had to hit along the way.
And actually, at the end of the day, you get three checks, because remember, Bombala, the concessionaire, they didn't, and it consisted out of Bouygues, a huge French company, and Murray and Roberts, one of the two biggest South African construction companies at that stage. But even the two of them couldn't do all the construction work themselves. So they subcontracted out to people like Concor and Basil Reed and actually a whole lot of smaller companies. So they also had to check whether their subcontractor finished the work, whether it was done properly. We did it, and I can come back to that a bit later, that we actually didn't approve, we monitored, but I'll come back to that later. And then the independent certifier also did it. So we were pretty sure that the work was well done.
The checks and balances were in place to ensure that nothing fell through the cracks. And again, the various milestones and deadlines were met.
At the end. Now, to come back to the finishing off of the development phase, we thought from our side that the leaks in the tunnel should be repaired before the line is opened. And the independent certifier decided no, he can certify it safe for opening, and it can be put onto the snag list and repaired later. And yes, there was no safety problem, but we felt it was so critically important for the project, we would have liked the concessionaire to repair that. That would have been a major exercise. I wouldn't guess how long it would have taken, but it could have taken another year or two. The concessionaire, of course, he wanted to open the line and get the start running the operations and get the income from it as soon as possible. So we had a difference with the independent certifier, which was only sorted out right at the end of all the disputes and claims and so on at the end of the project. But yes, that was the process that we went through.
Well, as if you look back now, many years later, what do you think some of the lessons that were learned during that entire procurement process, and how would you do things differently if you did it again?
Well, the lessons learned, and maybe I should also come back. I've referred to the political committee, the premier or the provincial executive, the provincial cabinet appointed a committee of three MECs. And they were given the full mandate to take all decisions. In the first year, we for example, had to submit the suggested route for Gautrain and a few other things. Then you become an item on the agenda of the provincial cabinet. You go through certain processes. It takes quite a time to get an item on the agenda for the provincial cabinet. Now you've got a provincial political committee who's got the mandate to take the decisions. They don't have to regularly meet every second Wednesday or so on. They can meet as and when necessary. And that helped us tremendously. I think it's one of the successes in the fact that political decisions we could have taken if it was really urgent. The rule was within 48 hours they had to get together and so on. So I would say that was an important lesson learned. The second one was our project leader, and we'll talk later on leadership, but it was very important to have somebody from government who had the experience, the knowledge of major projects and government rules financially and otherwise, legislation and so on, because then you have certainty as what can be done and how it can be done. We've spoken about the provincial support team. I think we had a very good support team. National Treasury, it was they've had a PPP unit. They still have a PPP unit, but you work with specific people in there. And we were fortunate to have very capable people at that stage who was not only on the regulation side checking whether we were complying, but also advising us. And I think it also provided integrity to the whole process to have your government's National Treasury also involved in the project on a very close basis. The evaluation process and criteria, I think, I've mentioned that, but I think we did quite well there. And I've referred to the whole arms deal, which was in the press at those stages. Yeah. We were approached by organizations saying to us, what are you going to do to make sure that you don't have any possible suggestions of corruption and irregularities? So we made 100% sure. And we even established a new process, which wasn't in other, we didn't have in other projects where we had what we called an anti-bribery pact, which we compiled and we signed with all the people. All our provincial support staff people also had to sign confidentiality documentation and so on, in order that everybody and also the bidders understand that everything will be done according to rules and regulations, which will not make provision for any possible irregularities or bribery or things like this. The bid cost compensation I referred to, I think that was also unique, but very important, because that kept the bidders here, good teams from their side, and they could give their full attention to the to the project. The delays, maybe, if I can close with that, because we thought it's going to take a year or two, and we were always very optimistic with all our programming in the project. But in the end, it took 5 years plus for the whole feasibility study, procurement, and so on. Now, the delays were the EIA, which was a huge EIA. It took a bit longer than we thought. The fact that we had to go through a sort of a double process in the bidding, because the first proposals exceeded the affordability limit, that also, uncertainties with regard to funding. When we started with the project, we thought province is going to fund the project on its own, but it became very clear later province won't be able to do it, and we needed to have national government support. And it was the years that Trevor Manuel was the Minister of Finance, and I can assure you he sent us back 10 times to redo certain analyses and cost estimates and so on to make 100% sure that this was a feasible project also from the financial side. And that put us back. And then, as I already said, the very long and complex negotiations with the preferred bidder, which we thought 4 to 6 months, and it was 15 months in the end. So that all added to the delays. But I think in the end, it was all worthwhile.
Well, Olaz, thank you very much for your time. We value your input. You've been listening to Olaz van Sail, former project coordinator on the Gautrain project. He's been providing us with insight into the lessons learned from that project, covering the issue of procurement. To listen to this and other interviews about the Gautrain, please tune in to our podcast at Gautrain Talk Station. You can also access further material on our website, www.gautrain.co.za, or follow us on Twitter.